And at this time, if you could all please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Loretta from the Penny Pack Group.
Hi, my name is Loretta. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I'm extremely nervous. This is my first time speaking at an hour meeting. And I said to my sponsor, you know, I'd like it to be a half an hour, so the other half an hour you guys can tell me how good I did. You know, it doesn't work like that anymore. So I'm extremely nervous. But I'm sober by the grace of God. I completely, wholeheartedly, honestly believe that today. I thought a lot of this I did on my own. I'd like to thank my friend for a long time, Shay, for asking me to come up here and speak. So my sobriety date is November 15th, 2001. I've been continuously sober since then. I do have a sponsor. I'm looking at her thing on Zoom right now. And I just was on the phone with her. I asked her to please say the set-aside prayer with me and the third and the seventh step prayer, which she did. And so she is teaching me. I've been through the steps. I've been through the steps 4 months sober when I got sober in 2001. And you'll hear throughout my story how my sobriety went with doing the steps and with without doing the steps. And with a reliance upon God and without a reliance upon God. And my sponsor told me to 20 minutes of what happened, 20 minutes of what it's like. No, I forget. 20 minutes, I'm so sorry. 20 minutes of what it was like, what happened, and what my life is like today. And so that's what I'm going to try to do to the best of my ability. And so when I did my steps at 4 months sober, it's completely different now. She's taken me through the steps. Sarah's taken me through the steps now. So in turn for that, I can now take other women through the steps, which I'm doing and experiencing it in a completely different way than when I got sober in 2001. So a little bit of what it was like. I grew up in a very alcoholic, drug addicted, suicide, mental health, graders for prison kind of family. And I know that I am alcoholic because of the way I drink and because of the way I use. I also do drugs alcoholically. I just learned that recently from somebody. My family's originally from Fishtown. I'm not. I left there when I was 7 years old, and I moved up to a small little town called Birdsboro. It's in between Reading and Pottstown. It's very country like this. And I was raised by my grandmother. My mom was very young when she had me. There's nobody in my family that has not been touched by this at all. On my father's side, I don't know, because I'd never met my father. My mom was very young when she had me. So growing up with my grandmother, she had 9 kids. So I was raised with the 2 youngest ones. They were identical twins. They were 11 years older than me. So when I was 3, they were 14. But when I got older, they were closer in age, if that makes any sense to anybody. You know, and as I look back, like, it's really funny. I have a cousin that's clean a long time in N.A. And I don't go to N.A. She doesn't come to A.A. But when Zoom happened, we would, like, go on each other's Zoom. And, like, you know, I'd hear her share. She'd hear me. So I was on a Zoom meeting speaking one day, and I said I came from a normal family, and she called me like 2 seconds after the meeting was over, and she's like, "You came from what kind of family?" And I'm like, "Normal." She said, "Loretta, it was the furthest thing from normal." But to me, it was normal because it was all I knew, you know. And my grandmother was a really strong woman, you know, verbally, like, you know, very, you know, right to the point. I remember her saying to me on numerous occasions, I'll just use this as an example, like, go in the kitchen and find the green bowl and bring it into me. And I remember running into the kitchen like, oh, my God, let me find this green bowl, because if not, I'm going to hear how stupid I am, how lazy I am, like, all of those kind of things. And that's just the way she talked. You know, now looking back, somebody would say that would be a verbal or emotional abuse or whatever. To me, it was just the way she talked. You know, like, I didn't explain it or need it any other way. But you know, looking back now, like, especially going through my steps again, you know, I drink because I'm alcoholically, and when I drink, I can't put it down. But I know that my thinking was conditioned a long time before that. And I know that the isms were all there, you know, every single one of them. You know, I believe that my first addiction was food. I remember, like, you know, raviolis, like the grossest thing in the world. But I would open them up as soon as my grandmother would leave the house and just like scarf them down. And if I heard her car coming back in the driveway, I would hide them like on this little lip in the bedroom closet. You know, like that's crazy, right? But that was like my first form of addiction. And I don't really know when I picked up first. I don't know if it was a drink. I don't know if it was something else, because everything was very open in my family, you know, and I was just exposed to it at a really, really early age. And it was okay. It was okay. And but I do remember the first time I got drunk. I remember that. I remember coming home. I threw up in bed. My grandmother caught cigarettes on me. She made me eat them. She would not let me get out of that bed at all. And it was gross. And I stayed there in that. And so I, you know, my uncles, everything that they did in my house was okayed. And my uncles did a lot of manufacturing and cooking a lot of stuff. And my grandmother benefited from it. So she had no arguments within it, you know, whatever. And you know, if she got a new driveway, if she got a new chimney, if she got a new car, like it was okay to do it all, you know, and that's just the way my family was. You know, you could smoke pot, but not in my house, go outside, like 2 steps outside, you know, and because my family was all from Fishtown, now we don't live on Norris Street or Susquehanna Ave. Like now we're up in the country on, you know, an acre of land. So they always had keg parties. They always had keg parties and everybody from Fishtown would come up. Right. So me and my cousin, you know, we would steal the roaches out of the ashtray and we would always be the one to go get them beer and take it back and forth and stuff like that. And I'll tell you, like, I'm one of them people, like, I did not like the taste of beer or alcohol, but I loved the effect. I remember the first time drinking it, like holding my nose because I hated the taste of it. I hated the smell of it. But once it went in me, like, I was good. I was good. And always fearful of everything and everybody, my own shadow, always a very nervous, anxious little girl. And I carried that from my home into school. You know, I was always the last to get picked on for a team. I was always the big girl in my class. I had a gap in between my teeth. I had Loretta as my name, which is an uncommon name. I had a grandmother that walked with a limp. She was older. Everybody then had, you know, young, cute mom and dad, and they were together. And now it's common for grandparents to raise kids, but back then it wasn't. You know, everybody else had beautiful homes, and we had this, like, little shack house that was, you know, had 2 bedrooms, a bathroom, running water and everything, but it didn't start out like that. You know, my grandmother bought this house. It was a one-room schoolhouse, and it didn't have a bathroom and running water and everything. It was like a summer house. You know, they had an outhouse and we put a bathroom in and stuff like that. So it was still like a little shack, you know. And so I grew up with all those insecurities and feeling inferior and feeling small. And even in my family, like my grandmother took me on after she was raising 9 kids as a widow, right? Her husband died in 66 and I was born in 67. And, you know, and then she had to raise me. And, I was just talking to Sarah about this yesterday, and you know, it was kind of like, you know, you don't ask to be born, right? We're born and we're here, you know. And but my grandmother, you know, her kids were almost already raised, except for the twins. They were 11 years old when I came onto this earth, and you know, and she was a widow, and she could have easily said no. You know, and I could have probably went into the system somewhere or a terminated pregnancy or whatever. And that wasn't the case. And she took me, and I know lovingly, like she wanted me to have a good life. But I used to always get the backlash from my uncles when I got older and I would act out and they would say, don't you know what grandma gave up for you? And, you know, your mom just dumped you, you know, all this stuff. And I would hear it echoing in my ears, like all the time, you know, and I hated it. And, so that's just the way I felt growing up, you know, and I didn't like it. I did not drink alcoholically in high school. I always say that because I would hear people when I first got sober say, like, I shook for a drink in 10th grade. I used to hide vodka in my locker, and I would separate myself because I'm like, that's not my experience. That didn't happen to me. Like, I must not be that bad, you know, but I was the type of person, I loved to smoke pot, huge pot smoker. I drank on the weekends as a teenager, you know, in school, I told you I was bullied, I was picked on, and there was a corner bar up there, and I fell in love with that scene immediately. I loved the shuffleboard. I loved the pool table. I loved playing darts. I loved all those things. I loved the smell of the beer, the bar. And we used to go roller skating. And since I was always the biggest girl and I looked older and everything, I would go across the street to this bar and I could get served. And we would go behind the skating rink and, you know, our parents would give us money to go into skate, and we never did that. We always collected it, went across the street to this bar, went behind the skating rink, drinking and smoking and doing all this. And then my other friends started getting served in this bar. And then something so magical happened was that my uncles were, the stuff they were manufacturing and cooking, they started to sell in that bar. And once all of these people that bullied me found that out, I automatically became the most popular girl in high school. Like, they loved me and they loved my uncles. And that was like a breaking point. That really was like a point for me where, things kind of turned my life around in the sickest way possible. But, you know, so I was, going to this bar. I remember being 21 years old and celebrating my 21st birthday in there, and the bartender, this lady named Girlie, she walked with a limp, she had like a hunchback, and you know, she, as soon as you walked through the door, she knew what you were drinking. She would put it right down in front of you. And I'm in there celebrating my 21st birthday, and she's like, "I've been serving you for the last 4 years." And someone behind me was like, "You do that with everybody in here. Like, nobody's of age in your bar, you know?" But it became the bar, you know? So I'm drinking, really not suffering any consequences, because at this point I'm really not drinking alcoholically. The only consequence I had at that point was, you know, my grandmother making me sleep in my own vomit. And there was nothing really at that point in my life that was, you know, saying like, I have a problem. I need to go here. I need to go there. I'm going to lose my marriage. I wasn't married yet. I didn't have any kids. I didn't have a home. So there was not really any consequences. And then this bar became everything. My baby shower was in this bar. I met my husband in the bar. My baby shower was in this bar. Every Wednesday, the night before Thanksgiving, we had this big family thing in the bar. My girlfriend got married in the bar. All these things. And while my teenage years are going on in my life, these uncles that I was like idolizing when I was younger, who I love, they started going to jail. My one uncle got sentenced 10 to 20 years in Gaithersburg prison. My family lied to us, to the kids, that he was going to college, and I believe that. we spent a lot of time in Gaithersburg prison room. They had tables like this in the visiting room, and when me and my cousin would get tired from being there all day long, we would lay down, and we weren't allowed to lay down because things going on underneath the table. I remember lots of times getting pulled up by the hair, like, you can't lay down, you know, because there's a husband and a wife or a girlfriend or whatever, you know, sitting next to each other. Like, it was just crazy. But that was all normal to me. You know what I mean? Like, I thought everybody went to Gaithersburg prison on Thanksgiving Day, you know? And it just, that was normal. That was so normal to me. So all this is happening. My one uncle is going in and out of rehab and detoxes, and my cousin now, you know, would skip down to my generation, and it's happening with her. And my mind was telling me that because I'm seeing all of this go on, that it's not going to happen to me. And Sarah just recently explained to me the necessity or the wish. No matter how much I did not want this to happen, it happened. It happened, and I did not want it to happen. I didn't want to wind up on my grandmother's couch at 40 years old. I did not want to have to experience jail. I didn't want to have to do all of those things, and that's what happened. That's my story. I got married. I had 3 kids in 4 years. My husband drank just like I did, worse than I did. And it got really bad really quick with my husband and myself. But because I lived in an area like this, we lived on a farmhouse. We had 3 acres of land, a little stream. You know, I had flower boxes in the window at my kitchen. Cows would come right up and eat out of the flower box. And I'm drinking every day. I'm smoking every day. Whatever my uncle has left over, I'm doing every day. And I went from a person that when somebody would ask me when I was 9 years old, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would say a mom, right? Because I wanted that family that I never had. Alcoholics always want what we don't have. And that's all I wanted to be. And what's crazy is my husband came from a really, really, really good family. And I was so attracted to his family. And he just wanted to be crazy. Like, he was the first one that had a tattoo, first one that had an earring in his ear, the only one in his family that had a DUI. Like, he came from, like, this family, you know, that I loved. And he was so attracted to my crazy family. Like, he loved them, you know. And we came together, and it's kind of like Freaky Friday. Like, I wanted to be him, and he wanted to be me, you know. And it just was crazy how we got together, and I thought I was going to be with him forever, and alcohol tore our family apart, me and my three children and him. And so that's basically how all of that went. And the more I was drinking, the more I lost. And the more I lost, the more I was drinking. And it was just spiraling, and I had no idea that it was, because I had this house, and we had a car, and he had a great job, and he was in the Navy, and you know, and I was staying at home with my kids, and there's, I say this all the time, and I don't say it to offend anybody, but in my family, it was very abnormal for somebody to be married and have all three kids by the same person, and I did, and I had, my kids had a last name. I never had a last name. I had my mom's maiden name that she grew up with, and so all of those things made me feel like I was different, like I wasn't nothing like my family. You know, I was special. I was special. This wasn't going to hit me the way it hit them. And it did. And it was. It was. And I had no idea that it was. You know, every insecurity, everything was right there, right in front of me. But I had no idea. I had no idea. I really thought that I married the wrong guy. You know, I had too many kids, too close in age. I came from a really messed up family. At this point, my one uncle, Danny, he was the youngest one, he had hung himself in that bar. And it was the night before Thanksgiving. And I was pregnant with my second daughter. He did this in November. She was born New Year's Eve. And, you know, so now my family's this downward spiral. My grandmother's, like, out of her mind, you know, the whole family. And I'm, like, stepping sideways out of the family. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, thank God. I'm just going to leave that all to the side. And I'm just going to live my life over here. And I waitressed. I waitressed. And I fell in love with this bar in Pottstown, right? And I used to waitress there in Pottstown, and you know, it's the same clientele. I would leave waitressing, we would go over to the bar across the street on High Street, and it was the same clientele. You know, everybody that was in the restaurant would go over to the bar. Everybody that worked at the restaurant would go over to the bar, and so you knew everybody. It was like real incestuous, this whole big pot of crazy people. And one night, the bartender asked me, you know, can you fill in a shift for me? I'm like, I don't work here. He's like, you do now. I'm like, okay. So I filled in a shift, and then before you knew it, instead of working 5 days at the restaurant, I was working three and then two over there, and then it went from two to three, and then I was full-time over at the bar and left the waitress job go. So at this time, me and my husband had split up, and he would get the kids every other weekend. I lied about him. I lied about him to get a protection from abuse order against him. I said he was mean, and he did mean things, and he hit me. I never lied and said he hit my kids, but I lied. I lied, and I made a total jerk off out of myself, out of him. You know, but I had no other way to get him out of the house so I could do what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to live a certain way of life. And he was the type of drunk that could work. He could work. And, you know, when my kids fell asleep on the floor, and he would say, are you going to put her to sleep? You know, and she's in a wet diaper on a cold floor. And I'm like, she's sleeping. Like, why would I wake her up and put her in the crib? She's sleeping. Let her go. But he cared about that kind of stuff. And he drank. You know, I didn't. And so I lied and got him removed from our house. And so every other weekend he would get the kids, and then I'd start calling him. I'd start calling him and asking him if he could keep them till Monday, you know. And he's like, no, I got to work. I'm like, well, then you're going to have to find a babysitter because you're not bringing them home tonight, you know, and very belligerent about it and things like that. So that's the way it went for a while, and a lot of other craziness happened in between that. I had another uncle, my Uncle Donnie, my Uncle Danny's twin brother, 5 years later, My Uncle Donnie and me were very, very close. He married my best friend from that bar. And 5 years later, he sat in a car and he ate a whole bunch of Xanax and drank something and he killed himself. So my grandmother just lost two kids within 5 years. And I'm still being rude and ignorant to her and no compassion whatsoever. And, you know, just all about me. The whole thing was all about me. Every part of my life was all about me. I didn't care about my kids not wanting to be with me. I didn't care about my grandmother needing some kind of comfort. I didn't care that every time I saw my mom, I made her feel like shit. I hated my mom. I didn't care about my cousin down in Kensington, lost. You know, I cared about nothing, nothing at all. And so what happened was in 1995, my cousin, who's now sober, approached me and she said, like, you know, you need to go away. I'm like, for what? And I'm thinking she's holier than thou. She's sober now, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I went away. I went to Eagleville. And when I went in there, they were talking. Somebody from H&I was talking, and they were saying all of these things about things I didn't experience yet. They were talking about being homeless, selling their food stamps, going to jail, Kensington Avenue, custody, probation officers, you know, all of these things. And I'm like, whoa, slow down. Like, I think I want my husband back now. I want to go back. Like, you know, this is not where I belong at all. You know, so from 95 until 2001, that's what I did. I left every place I went. All of those I nevers came true. I wound up homeless. I'm not in Philadelphia anymore because my uncles, when they grew up in Fishtown, either all the people they knew were either opening up recovery houses because they were sober now and they got out of jail, right? So they're opening up recovery houses, which was great. Or they were dead or they were still behind bars. Right? Or they were sober outside. And so my uncle was like, this guy's opening up, you know, he has this recovery house open, blah, blah, blah. And it was this place called Somerset Project. It was on Kensington Avenue. And they took me there. They took me there, right? In 96 or 97, I forget where. But they took me there and no clue what AA is about, nothing, nothing. There was words I never even heard before I came into AA. Had no idea the word resentment, none whatsoever. God's will, his will, character defect, like I knew none of those terms. They were not even a part of my vocabulary. I don't even think they came out of my mouth once before I came into AA. So I go to this recovery house and, you know, I walk in, they, you know, give me this room. There's like an ironing board there. Everybody irons in my room, right? There's water dripping from the ceiling. They have a pot of water cooking on the stove with like broken hot dogs. So when you get hot dogs with a sandwich, you had to like put the hot dogs together on a piece of bread and fold it, right? So I'm like, oh my God, like this is not happening to me, right? Selfish. I can't believe I'm here. These people are crazy and there's nothing wrong with me. So, the next morning we wake up and we're all, you know, doing morning meditation. We're all picking these books up. I'm like, I don't have a book. What is everybody doing? They pick up these books and we're all standing in a circle afterwards and they're like, let the new girl take us out. Well, I know it's me, right? And they said, Loretta, who woke us up this morning? I said, Lynette. Like she came by and knocked on everybody's door and woke me up, right? So, that's what it was like. And that continued for a long time. I would go in and out. I was at New Life, that was my home group for a while. I tried to get sober there. I didn't. The Avenue group, that was another place I tried to get sober. I didn't. The Northeast Club, I was there for a while trying to get sober. I got banned from there because there's a lot of hot dog stories in my story. I'm just realizing that now. I got banned from there because it was like the 4th of July, and they only had meetings upstairs. And downstairs, they used to have the parties and anniversary speakers and stuff like that. So I decided, never had Crazy Horse before in my life, right? I thought you could just like drink that like you were drinking. It was crazy and totally blacked out. I don't remember any of this, but I walked in there apparently and they had a crock pot full of hot dogs and sauerkraut with a long extension cord. And I like pulled the plug with my foot when I went in, knocked everything down, burned two people with hot dog stuff and, you know, And I was told about that. I was told about that because I went back. I never wanted to leave that place because I felt safe there, even drunk and high. And I went back and there was like, you know, they used to put papers on the door, like, you're banned. You know, my name was up there and I'm like, why? You know, and then somebody told me. But they didn't, they let me in that day. They let me in that day. But that's just the way it was for me trying to get sober. And what I knew how to do in between 95 and 2001 was I knew how to get a home group. I knew how to get a sponsor. I knew what a big book looked like. I knew how to get a white chip, right? One time I went to get a white chip, my sponsor was like, sit down. She wouldn't even let me walk up to the table. She's like, sit. I'm like, okay. So, but I knew how to do a lot of things. I had no clue on how to stay sober at all, at all. You know, I would go to meetings, you know, probably because I didn't stay long enough. Nobody ever came up to me and said, I want to take you through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I would have stayed, somebody might have said that to me. They might have said that to me, but I shut them out just like I did people in Eagleville. I was in Eagleville so many times, and I don't say this to, like, get a laugh or, you know, somebody to look at me funny or anything, but there used to be this old guy in Eagleville, the lobby, right? And he would, like, mop, you know, and empty trash and stuff like that. And I knew I was there too many times when I came back one time, and he said to me, how are the kids doing? He's like, Dylan, right? Isn't that your son's name? And I'm like, oh, I said, how do you know that? I talked to him every time I was sitting in there. Like, I was in there so many times, you know, and it was crazy. And I look back at that now, you know, and I'm like, you know, and then years later, my son winds up there, but that's a different story. But my last time, I had lost custody of my kids. You know, I'm down in Kensington. They tell me to stay away from Dunkin' Donuts at K&A. Well, where do I go? Right to Dunkin' Donuts at K&A. And then that whole world of Kensington was exposed to me. You know, but there was a Kensington in Reading, too. Like, there's a down the way in every town. You know, I'm sure you don't have to go 10 minutes from here. You know what I mean? Like, it's just everywhere. But in 2001, like, a lot of my bottoms, you know, the Salvation Army steps next to the Northeast Club, you know, I was there one time. I went into treatment from them steps with nothing, a bag, nothing else, you know. And I would fall asleep there. I would wake up with, like, gravel stuck to the side of my face. And I remember this one time. This is a funny story now when I think about it. There used to be a carpet place right next to the Northeast Club. And there was an abandoned car there. And it was raining out one night. And so, you know, sleeping on the steps, like, you know, you're outside. You don't want to get wet, right? So this guy that I'm with pulls this carpet underneath this car, and we both lay under there to go to sleep. And he's singing that song, When a Woman, Man Loves a Woman, You Sleep Out in the Rain. And I'm like, oh, my God, he loves me so much, right? And we're sleeping under this car, right, like crazy. I had his name tattooed on my chest, and he had Loretta down his arm. Not like Lynn, like something you can get covered up, Loretta. And he was married. He was married, and you know, crazy, and but it just, you know, all that craziness. So in 2001, I will step it up. 2001, I am living up in Birdsboro. I moved back up into Birdsboro because I want to get custody of my kids back, right? So it's 6 years later. I move back up to Birdsboro, and the judge. I go in front of the judge, and he says that I have to be employable, I have to have a permanent residence, I have to have pay stubs, that's employable. I had to give clean urines, I had to do all of these things. I had to live in their school district. My ex-husband lived around the corner, still drinking, but taking care of my kids. I still hated him. I hated the fact that he could drink, take care of my kids, and they loved him. And so we're living there, me and this guy that was one of my friends of my uncle's that was in Graders for probably longer than my uncle. But I met him in a recovery house, and, you know, the type of guys I like, they had, like, bandanas on, teardrop tattoos on their face, and I'm like, I'm going to marry him and have a whole bunch of babies because I messed up with my first three, you know? And so I'm with him, right? He's scary. He's a lot older than me. I'm petrified of him, but we're going to live happily ever after. So we move up to Birdsboro, right? Now, he's straight from Kensington, just got out of jail, and I move him up to Birdsboro. Right, which was horrible. I think the whole 30-mile radius, like, he tortured everybody. And I just sat next to him like, okay, whatever you say, I'll do it, you know. And so what happens is We're drinking up there. Everything in my apartment is there on Tuesday. Thursday, it's all gone, except for the weight bench. Like, we can never sell the weight bench because of his ego. Like, he had to be, you know. And so the weight bench was there, and we're going back to Evilville. But what happened, this was God working in my life way before I ever knew it. And my son comes by on a skateboard, right? We had a big plate glass window in front of the apartment. And my son comes by on a skateboard. He sees me, and he comes in, right? He was allowed in my house at that point. He comes in, and he says, "What's going on?" And I said, "I'm going away." And he's like looking at the bag that I'm sitting there. I said, "I'm going away." And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going back into the hospital because I have headaches." And so throughout the last 6 years, I always hear about God, higher power, turning it over, pray in disbelief, you know, but I never paid attention to any of it. Cause I had from here to there was like, so I could not even concept any of that in my life. I did not grow up going to church. The only thing I remember about church is if somebody did something wrong to our family, like we weren't doing wrong to everybody else, but if somebody did something wrong to our family, my grandmother would always say like, God will take care of them, you know, and that's the only thing I ever remember about church or God, you know. So when my son said this to me, I went into the kitchen in total disbelief and just looked up and I said, "Please, God, let me stop hurting my kids," right? And it was that simple prayer. And I'll tell you what, I wanted to be sober so many times, but wanting it wasn't enough. I'd want it so bad. I would say, "God, please, I want to be sober. I want to be sober." And it would never happen. It would never happen. And I never asked for the willingness. But that day when I said that prayer, the willingness was immediately right there. You know, Sarah just showed me in the book that the bright white light experience that Bill W. has, like, not everybody has that, you know. And I believe, like, you know, I sponsor girls now, and they say to me, like, "When am I going to get it? When am I going to get it?" Like, that white light thing, like, it doesn't happen for everybody. It did for me that day. It happened that day. And the willingness was just automatically there. And Sarah also says, I was joking with Claire about this the other day, like a drowning man doesn't ask for help. Somebody in, I forget what it is, and Sarah will laugh at me later when I tell, well, she's hearing it right now. But yeah, so anyway, the willingness was there immediately, and I was willing to do whatever it took. You know, so I go into Eagleville with this guy. You know, when he's driving there and he's like, "Loretta, 30 days, we're out of there. Jake's going to get me a job, hook me up, blah, blah, blah." And I'm looking out the window like, "Please do something with him because I know that I'm going to stay and I'm going to do whatever it takes." You know, I didn't say a day at a time. Like, I was staying sober the rest of my life at that point, you know. And so we get to Eagleville. We get thrown out because we're caught being, you know, buddies together and stuff. And I go back to this recovery house that I was in numerous times. And I'm back in there. And I stay there for a year, and I'm getting visitation rights with my kids, and he stayed there for a year, and then we get a year sober, and we decide we're going to move out together, and we're going to live in Fishtown. So we get a house in Fishtown. When I first got to that recovery house, they gave me the name of a sponsor, and they said, "Do you remember Maria?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "She's going to sponsor you." And I'm like, "Okay." So I had gotten sober with Maria in this recovery house in 95. She stayed sober and I didn't. And we used to get high together. So I go over to her house, and it's just like when Bill answered the door for Abby Thatcher, like something was different about him. I knocked on the door, she answered the door, and everything about her was different. The way she stood, the way she talked, the way she approached me, the way she gave me a hug. Like before she was like real thuggish, you know, all this and everything else. She was nothing like that. And that was attractive right away. Like, I wanted that. And she said to me point blank, she's like, "I know your history. I know how you come in and out of here. I know what your goals are." My goals at that time was a pen, a black apron, because I waitress, a for rent sign in a room, and a guy to take care of me, you know. And that had to end. Like, that ended, you know. So I started working with her right away. You know, I told her about God and how I felt and what I didn't believe and what I think I believe. and all of these things. And she said, do you believe it worked for me? We came from the same world, Loretta. And I'm like, absolutely. She said, hold on to that belief. You know, so I start working with her every week. Things are happening, and they're happening quickly. And I am just completely believing that it worked for her and it would someday work for me, you know. And one of the biggest eye-opening moments for me in my sobriety was I waitressed down in Center City, and I used to have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and everybody else is still sleeping. And when you came out of the door on Stella Street, you could make a right and go to Monmouth Street, which I frequented a lot, or you could go left and go up to Frankfort Avenue and get on the bus. So every day I'm doing my hair, I'm doing my makeup, and I'm like, I'm going to Monmouth Street. And I really believed that. And every day I would walk out the door and I'd be on the bus crying. I'm like, well, I didn't do it today, but I know tomorrow I'm going to do it, you know? So I called her finally after I tortured myself for 2 weeks. I mean, we're working together, but I'm not telling her this. I'm not being honest with you. I want to keep this for myself in case it really does happen, you know? And then I have to beat a urine in a recovery house, which I did numerous times before. So I call her. I call her and I tell her what I'm experiencing. And she said, do me a favor. She said, ask God to direct your thinking in the morning. And I'm like, okay. So I start doing that. I'm like, you know, and it's going back and forth in my head. God direct my thinking, Mama Street, back and forth. And this is still going on. I'm like, this is not working at all. So then I get on the bus one day and we're driving along. I don't know if anybody ever saw the Joker movie where the guy starts laughing on the bus, like outside, like out loud to himself. That was me. I started laughing out loud, and tears coming down my face. And I'm like, oh my God, I am on the bus. I've been awake for 2 hours, and the thought of Mama Street never even crossed my mind. Like, it worked. The prayer worked. It took a while, right? But it worked. It didn't work immediately, but it worked. And by saying it and having that experience, like, I really believed like something was happening in my life that was not of my doing. Like, there was no human hand mixed in that whatsoever. So I continued going through the steps with her. And one of my biggest questions was, what is a will and how do I turn it over? Right? So, you know, she was taking me through the steps, and she said, basically, by doing the third step, you're agreeing to go through with the rest of the steps. You know, it's a willingness. And by going through the rest of the steps, you're turning your will over. And somewhere along that line, things are going to start to change. And things started changing. I did a fifth step with her. I told Sarah this the other day. I was not, you know, I don't remember if I took that hour with God or not, but I was not happy that I did a fifth step. I was really mad. I thought that she found all the information about me. She knew all my relatives in AA. We all made the same meeting. She was going to tell everybody. She was going to put it on the clipboard and pass it around. And it was just a horrible feeling. But then, you know, I started praying about 6 and 7, and my character defects were all over the place. But I was still very willing to do whatever it took. I had an 8th step list of amends I had to make. My first amends was to my mom. And this is when I finally realized that God was going to do for me what I could not do for myself. I was making an amends to my mom. I hated her. I did not like being around her. I was embarrassed of her. I didn't like the fact that she left me with my grandmother. I didn't like the fact that everybody in my family hated her. None of that. So we're driving back up to Berks County. I'm holding her hand. The windows are down. The oldies are on, and I'm like, this is it. It's the perfect time. And I really don't think I knew a lot then about amends. Not the way Sarah. Sarah is the kindest, gentlest soul. Like, the way she's taken me through this is, like, unbelievable. But I didn't know how to make a right amend, but I was doing what was on my heart. And I grabbed my mom's hand, and I said to her, I'm sorry that I thought bad of you. I'm sorry for the names I called you, the way I disrespected you, and I'm here for you, and I love you. And she looked out the window, and she said, can you believe they're going to build a damn Pizza Hut over there? And I'm like, oh. She did not just say that. I said it in my head, not out loud. And then my next thought was, yeah, this is my mom. This is her. You know, and I didn't get upset. I just accepted her for who she was. you know, and then I knew that I was going to be okay. I knew that something was definitely changing within me because everything I had was a reaction. I always had a reaction to something. I always wanted somebody to see me the way I thought I should be seen, you know, my whole entire life. Like when I was the last person picked for like the soccer team, when everybody else is picked and they're like, oh, I'll take Loretta, you know, like I wanted them to see me different. I didn't want them to see me like the way I felt about myself, you know, my entire life. And that day when I made the amends to my mom, I don't, you know, they say like it's not about that day. I felt comfortable. I felt okay, you know, and I knew she heard me, but she didn't know how to, you know, and it just took off. It took off. My life took off. You know, I was sponsoring women while I was still living in a recovery house, taking women through the steps, very active in AA, you know, taking commitments. I got custody of my children back at 18 months sober. My son did not want to come with me. He had a choice. He chose to go with his dad. Things were really, really going along really good. I went back to college. I went to college. I never was in college. I went to college. I didn't get a degree, but I did get a certificate. I prayed about that guy leaving me. Please, please, please get him out of my life because I'm too afraid to leave and I'm afraid. I'm scared. I'm afraid of him. And I kept praying and praying. Please, God, remove him. Well, he robbed 3 banks and he went back to prison. So he was removed from my life quickly. And then I got married to somebody in AA, who I'm still married to. And he's the only person in my life that I don't have a drinking past with. And I'm very grateful for that. Our sobrieties are very different. They're very separate. He does his thing. I do my thing. I think that's important for people, especially my home group, to know, because sometimes people won't let me sponsor them. They don't want me to sponsor them because my husband's there and it's just this big conflict. But so what happened was, a lot of stuff happened, and a drowning man doesn't ask questions. That's what Sarah tells me, right? So, and I was joking with Claire. I said, you know, I pulled God into that boat. He reached his hand out to me, and I pulled him in, and I drove it for a little bit, and I told God, get out. I got this. I'll be good without you, right? So that's what I started to do, and I became, you know, I became like a fellowship queen. You know what I mean? Like, I would walk into a room, and I was like, hey, Loretta, how you doing? How's the kids? And, you know, all this. And I'm like, good. And, you know, I would share the most insidious, heinous thing in the world, crying my eyes out, playing the victim. It's everybody else's fault. Boo-hoo, nobody likes me. And a girl would come up to me after the meeting and say, I really like what you share. I want what you have. Will you sponsor me? I'm like, you're kidding me, right? Like, no. No, sorry, you know? So a whole bunch of things happened and kind of like a perfect storm. And I slowly, and now I used to say like the first 13 years of my sobriety were really good, and it wasn't. I'm going through the steps now, like things are more awakening for me. And I slowly got away from the steps. I slowly started giving up my belief in God. I completely relied upon myself. And what happened was, from 95 until 2001, I kept trying to rearrange my life. You know, if this is here, I'll do this. If he goes there, I'll see her. Like, it was just a constant rearranging of everything. No reliance, no dependence, no help from anybody else. I'm the victim. Feel sorry for me. Blah, blah, blah. And that's what I started doing. I started doing that. You know, completely pushed God aside. Stop doing the steps. I didn't sponsor anybody for 6 years. 6 years, right? I became very confrontational with everybody and anybody. I did a lot of serious damage to my husband. My son, mental illness took off. I was down to Roundup with a bunch of women, like 30 women. I got a phone call. They said, we have you listed as Dylan's last of kin. And I'm like, so that's my son? And he cut his own throat, and he was in the hospital. He did not die. He's still alive today. But thank God I was down there with all of them women, right? Because if I was at home, who knows? I was so detached from AA. But I was a fellowshipper, and there's nothing wrong with fellowship. I'm not saying that to knock that or anything. We need that. But we need more than that. I needed more than that. My internal feeling and my crazy head, I need more than just fellowshipping. And I didn't know that. I thought that I was going to be okay in AA, just making meetings. And so 13 years sober. Before that, let me back up. 11 years sober, my son had a baby with a girl, and we got custody of her when she was 3 months old. My two daughters are very successful at the time. They were 17 and 18 years old. We bring this baby home. My life's falling apart. My husband's down at the Harvest Fest with Chuck Lorre, praising Jesus with my daughters, and I'm sitting on the edge of my bed with my granddaughter behind me in a crib, and I take a gun out of the top of the closet. And I didn't cry like I am now. I didn't shake. I didn't do any of them things, but I didn't want to be here anymore. I didn't want to be here with this precious little gift of a baby sitting behind me. And there was a voice that just said, like, no, this is not what you want. And I put the gun back. So I went to church. I went to church for a year and a half. And I thought, I'll go to church. I'll find God again. He'll find me and I'll be okay. So a year and a half of that, it still didn't work. And I did not go to AA. My husband continued to go to AA. My daughters were petrified of me. I couldn't change my granddaughter's diaper without help. It just got really, really bad. So for the next 6 years in AA, I became the same person I was drinking. I was lying. I was cheating. I was stealing. And still making meetings and still believing I was okay. I was hiding behind my time. I heard Claire say that. Sorry. But I was hiding behind my time. I was hiding behind the fact that I lived with my husband who was sober. My marriage was so ready to crumble. That little girl was a gift from God. Like, she saved my life. So somebody came up to me about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. They came up to me and they said, what's going on with you? I'm like, what do you mean what's going on with me? And they said, every time you're at a meeting, you're crying, you're doing this, you're not really talking about a solution, you know, and when are you going to do something about that? And I really got mad. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, and she says, look, let me help you, you know, and as she's saying it, it went from anger to help me, but not verbalizing it. Like, my lips started quivering, my eyes were all filled up, and I'm like, okay, you know, so I go over to her house. I look forward to going over the next time, and she said, who are you praying to? And I'm like, real sarcastic. I'm like, isn't that personal, you know? She's like, well, that's not what I mean. Are you praying? I'm like, yeah, I'm praying. She says, well, what are you praying? I said, I just pray, Jackie. I don't know. I say, thank God, wake me up, put me to bed. Like, I don't know, you know? And she says, well, why don't you try praying to the same God that got you sober? And that was it. That's why she was put in my path for that immediate moment. Because after that happened, I didn't look forward to going to her house anymore. And she's a wonderful woman. And she was doing a great job. You know, she started talking about some of her problems, which I was fine with, but I just did not look forward to going there anymore. And when she said, pray to the same God that got you sober, that kickstarted something back up in me. That was another seed planted, right? So after you're almost 20 years sober, you think you're planted enough, right? That's what I was thinking in my head. Like, do I really need to, like, learn anything new, you know? And it's a sick, twisted way to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to stay sober because there was nothing sober about my thinking at all. Physically, I was as physically sober as I was November 15, 2001. But mentally, I was tortured. Tortured. I used to share. I said this with Sarah. I used to put my hand up and share. This was 2 years ago. Hi, I'm Loretta. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. And I would say in my head, fuck, I'm not grateful. I don't want to be here. Like, why am I saying that? And she said, it's a jet stream of shit just coming out of your mouth, you know? But anyway, so a friend of mine had a sponsor. She said, come on to a Zoom meeting, listen to her speak. I signed on to the Zoom meeting. Two minutes, Sarah had my attention. And I wanted to hear her again. And I asked Tina, I said, tell me when she's on Zoom again. And she told me. And I wanted to ask her to be my sponsor, but she was my friend's sponsor. And my ego and my pride said, she's not going to be able to sponsor you. She'll tell you no, you know? And she asked Tina for my phone number. And then she texted me and she said, like, I'm here if you ever need help. You know, and I'm like, I need help inside. You know, and she's helped me. She's helped me. And I'm now relying on God. Believe me when I tell you, me and Shay have known each other a very long time. And when she asked me, would you speak at my home group? I read the text like 21 times. I'm like, she really asked me this? Like, I can't believe she's asking me this. You know, and of course I said yes for two reasons. I wanted to stay in service and I wanted to see my old friend, Shay. You know, but Sarah has me on a journey that I didn't think at almost 20 years sober I would need again. You know, but it just reassures me that this is a day at a time process. It doesn't matter how much time you have. You know, I disconnected myself so far away from God. I disconnected myself so far away from instrumental women in AA that talk about a solution, that their lives get repaired. They get repaired and they live good lives. They come an hour before a meeting and introduce you to their friends. It's just a great feeling. I didn't think I'd be able to talk for an hour, but I think I can talk for another one. but I'm not going to because it's 8:57. But there's such a message of hope to give somebody else when you live by the spiritual principles of AA. I said to Sarah, I'm like, I'm reading all these feet first speakers on there. I can't quote nothing. I had a head injury. I have short-term memory loss, blah, blah. And she said, it's your experience, strength, and hope, Loretta. And I can relate to a lot of things in the big book. I can't quote them. I can relate to them. And that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. When I read Bill's story, she said to highlight everything that I can relate to his thinking, drinking, and the way he acts or something like that. And when I went through that, I was like, oh my God, like this was a guy, stockbroker, I'm a woman, waitress, you know, 2001, 1935, like, you know, but when I actually read that and highlighted it and we went through it together, it was like unbelievable. But anyway, my reliance today is completely on God. I go to him with everything. I pause and pray. I don't pause and reload, right? Because that's what she told me I did one day. You pause and reload it. The bedevilments in the book, the last 6 years, loaded with them. I would go to work. We were just talking about this the other day, but I can't talk about it anymore because it's almost over. But anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I like these hour meetings now, right? So I'm just really blessed to be a sober woman in AA, a woman of honor and dignity. I told Sarah that. I hate that saying. And the other night, after we did a fifth step, I said, you know why I hated that saying? Because I wasn't that. I wasn't a woman of honor and dignity. I believe that I'm on my way to that today. You know, so I hope everybody has a good night. That's it.